Acts 9:36 through 9:43. The 36th talk in a series on the Book of Acts was presented by Jack Crabtree on January 16, 2000 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2000. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle. This is the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side. Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the first few minutes of this talk.
To Bill Moore's question in a little bit more detail, Bill was asking, couldn't the chronology of this section of Acts, we're in Acts 9, verses, well, roughly 31 through the end of chapter 9 of Acts, wouldn't it make sense, in fact, arguably, wouldn't it make more sense to see the chronology that these churches here in Joppa and Lydda were founded by Philip? Because we have earlier in Acts, Philip, after meeting up with the Ethiopian eunuch, he traveled up the coast to Joppa and Caesarea, and Lydda is very near Joppa. So couldn't he have founded these churches, and Peter is coming along later? And I don't imagine it was really very clear why I landed on the chronology that I did. My answer to Bill was that I'm inclined to think that this is contemporaneous with Philip, that around the same time Philip and Peter must have met up and they did the evangelism in this area. What I was trying to do is to construct a chronology that would make sense for me out of why these accounts are here in this place, in this location in the Book of Acts. And many of you don't care, and you're wondering why on earth is he spending his time on this, and I don't know, but it's just me. I'm just trying to figure this out. But in the process of thinking about something entirely different this week, it occurred to me that there may be a different reason why these passages are here. Remember the way this Acts 9 is constructed. He's talked about Paul. He's given us a little bit of the early chronology of Paul, his conversion and his early attempts at evangelism. And as I argued, what seems to be the case is that Luke is trying to make clear that in this early chronology of Paul's life, he was an unsuccessful evangelist to the Jews. And he's really stressing the unsuccessfulness of Paul here. It may very well be that what Luke is doing is, instead of connecting verses 32 through 43 with chapter 10, which is what I suggested last week, maybe we should see the end of 9 as connected with verse 31, which reads as follows: "So the church throughout all Judea and Galilee and Samaria enjoyed peace, being built up and going on in the fear of the Lord and in the comfort of the Holy Spirit. It continued to increase," for example, and then gives a couple of accounts that do not involve Paul. They involve Peter, which goes on to carry on the same rhetorical purpose that Luke has had throughout the rest of the chapter. Paul was a failure as an evangelist to the Jews. But it wasn't because the Jews were not responding altogether, because obviously they were responding. In Lydda, in Joppa, throughout all of Judea, the church was being built up, but not at the ministry of Paul. Now, how fair is that? You know, one of the things that it really highlights for me is the importance of recognizing the providence, the sovereignty of God in the effectiveness of anything that we do as servants of God, as people who are ministering on Jesus' behalf. The effectiveness, as Paul tells us in Corinthians, is left up to the Spirit of God. It's not up to me. Paul is proclaiming the same message in Judea that Peter is proclaiming. They listen to Peter, they won't hear Paul. Now, why is that? Because God had an entirely different role for Paul. And one of the ways that God steers us, one of the ways that he guides us, one of the ways he gets us where we're going, is by granting success or failure along the way. It works, it doesn't work. You're received, you're not received. It's accepted, it's not accepted. And it's not about me. It's not about I'm not doing it right. It's not about I'm not godly enough. It's not about any of those things. It's about the sovereignty of God putting people where He wants them to be. If that's what's going on here, then my answer to Bill is actually that's probably a better chronology. The timing doesn't matter then if that's what he's doing. It doesn't have to be all of this taking place to explain why he's in the vicinity of Caesarea, which is what I suggested last week. If his purpose here is just to illustrate with a couple of dramatic examples the impact of Peter's ministry, then who knows when they occurred. They could have occurred any time in this time frame. Okay, another thing that struck me about verse 31. Notice, it's so easy to miss this because this is so much a part of our vocabulary, so much a part of our own Christian jargon that it doesn't even startle us. But when you think about it in the right way, it's very striking. Notice that he says, "So the church throughout all Judea and Galilee and Samaria enjoyed peace." Well, of course. Until we recognize that he clearly cannot be talking about an institution here, for one. This is the church throughout all Galilee, throughout all Samaria. And he is already, real early on, using the term church in a way that we're somewhat comfortable with, referring to the church meaning simply the believing community. The community, that set of people who have become disciples and who have declared their allegiance to Jesus and so on. We're comfortable with that use of the term, but that's the way Luke is using it here, which is significant because the other way we're comfortable using the term, and in fact we would argue that it's the primary way to use the term, is to refer to various institutions that we have built for God or for Jesus. But this very early use of the word church in Luke's account, it's not an institution that he's referring to. The basic primary idea for Luke is that set of disciples, that set of people who are followers of Jesus. The other thing that probably escapes our notice entirely is that not a single cotton pick in one of these people is Gentile. And we're so accustomed to thinking of there's Judaism over here and there's Christianity over here, and Christianity, that's where the church is. It's the Christians who have built the church. But not so here. Not a single one of these, unless they were straggling Gentile God-fearers in their midst. Probably not a single one of these are Gentiles yet. Not until we get to chapter 10 do we see finally Gentiles being exposed. This is unrelated to Luke's point, of course, but I do think it's important that we continue to keep in mind and that we continue to remind ourselves that the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God, is ultimately a Jewish gig, not a Gentile gig. It's so easy for us at our point in time in history, because having rejected the Messiah, God has visited the unbelief of their fathers on two and three generations and has not kept his promises to the Jewish people as a people. It's so easy for us, since we see such a preponderance of believers in Jesus, or what appears to us to be a preponderance of believers in Jesus, to be Gentiles, it's so easy for us to lose sight of the fact that all of us as Gentiles have been grafted in to something that is fundamentally Jewish. Now, not fundamentally Jewish in the sense that it's not for us Gentiles. It was for us Gentiles from the very beginning. The promise made to Abraham was that all the nations of the earth will be blessed in you. So it's for us in that sense. But it is not for us in the sense that God has ever chosen any other people to be the vehicle and the conduit of his blessings and his revelation and his... And there's no other people on the face of the earth who will ever experience the sort of totally, entirely sanctified society that God has one day promised for the Jewish people. it's easy, in other words, it's easy for us to think that there's Jews, which is a people, and there are Gentiles, which is a people, and God is not working with the Jewish people, he's now working with the Gentile people. That's not exactly right. There are the elect among both Jews and Gentiles. God has set the work that he's going to do with the entire nation and the entire people of Jews aside in order to work with the individual elect among the Gentiles who are not a people, but who are just not Jews. To call myself a Gentile is not to make myself identified with a group of people. It's to say I'm not of the chosen people of God. And if I don't like the fact that I'm not of the chosen people of God, tough. That's part of what I have to come to terms with in dealing with God, is God is not fair. God is not equitable. He blesses whom he blesses with whatever he wants to bless them, and he doesn't bless other people. And we have to come to terms with the question in the face of that, is he good anyway? Will I love him anyway? Will I follow him anyway? Will I obey him anyway? Or will I accept the limitations, the deprivations, the so on that he's given to me? So throughout the book of Acts here, as we go on, pay attention to the degree to which God is dealing with his people according to his promises. Some of that is judgment. Some of that is turning away from his people and saying, if you will not believe now, then I'll get back to you on your promises. I'm not going to forsake the promises. For the sake of your father, I'm not going to forsake you as a people. But you have been unbelieving, and I'm going to go and gather out the elect from the Gentiles, and I'll get back to you later. And it is a kind of judgment, yes. I think it's portrayed that way in a couple of places. But he never rejects the Jewishness of what he's doing. Okay. We go on now to the next account. We looked at the account of the healing of Aeneas. Now we go and look at Dorcas in Greek, Tabitha or Dorcas, verse 36 and following. Now in Joppa there was a certain disciple named Tabitha, which translated in Greek is called Dorcas. This woman was abounding with deeds of kindness and charity, which she continually did. And it came about at that time that she fell sick and died, and when they had washed her body, they laid it in an upper room. And since Lydda was near Joppa, the disciples, having heard that Peter was there, sent two men to him, entreating him, "Do not delay to come to us." And Peter arose and went with them, and when he had come, they brought him into the upper room, and all the widows stood beside him weeping and showing all the tunics and garments that Dorcas used to make while she was with them. But Peter sent them all out and knelt down and prayed, and turning to the body, he said, "Tabitha, arise." And she opened her eyes, and when she saw Peter, she sat up. And he gave her his hand and raised her up, and calling the saints and widows, he presented her alive. And it became known all over Joppa, and many believed in the Lord. And it came about that he stayed many days in Joppa with a certain tanner, Simon. Okay, this is clearly happening immediately before his visit to Caesarea to see Cornelius. This happens, and he's in Joppa, and the disciples from Caesarea come down to fetch him. So whenever that happened, that's when this is happening. What do we know about this woman, or what does Luke tell us about this woman? Dorcas is full of, they put it here, kindness and charity. The idiom to be full of something typically means to be characterized by that thing. If we are full of courage, we are courageous. If we are full of love, we are loving. That idea. She is full of kindness, and they translate it charity, but the idea seems to be what we would call charitable works. And as we see later, as the passage goes on, apparently her charity took the form of making tunics and garments for people, and she would simply make garments for them and give these garments to people as an act of charity, as a merciful thing to do, as just an act of incredible, profound kindness. We may not appreciate the extent of this kindness in our day and age because clothes are relatively cheap for us. But clothes in these days are really pretty dear and pretty precious. It's not unusual for a person to own only one tunic or possibly two tunics, and that's their entire wardrobe. I mean, they just, it was all handmade. It was, they beat the flax themselves. They did the whole process themselves, and clothes were not easy to come by. So this is a pretty substantial act of kindness for a woman to make an entire wardrobe possibly for someone and give it to them out of the goodness of their heart. This is a pretty remarkable lady. One of the things that is noteworthy about this is, well, okay, why is that relevant? Let's address that first. Why is it relevant that she's that kind of lady? If you're that kind of lady, you die, God will raise you back from the dead. Some people may reason so, but there is nothing to suggest anything like that anywhere in the New Testament, that God rewards the quality of a person's life by a miracle of any kind, let alone raising them again from the dead. Raising people from the dead is relatively rare in the Bible, if you've noticed. It happened here once in Peter. Maybe Paul did when the guy fell out of the window, but he wasn't up about to get buried. I mean, he had just died if he had died. The number of times that somebody is being mourned in the upper room by professional mourners happens, what, twice? And then I think just once in the Old Testament, Elijah raised the widow's son. I can't remember if there are any more. But it's relatively rare. Mostly, godly people die and stay dead, mostly. So there's no kind of correlation that if you're a good person, this miracle is going to happen to you. Why then is it such a big deal that she's this sort of lady? I think the way Luke is portraying this, the reason it's significant is because she is so dear to the community. She has endeared herself to everyone in the city. If you look at when Peter comes to the upper room, when he had come, they brought him into the upper room, and all the widows, undoubtedly these were the benefactors of her kindness. Widows were the most disenfranchised people in ancient Palestinian society. You are so much dependent upon a male in your life that when that male who was your protector and your provider died, you had no social standing whatsoever, and you were completely disenfranchised economically, politically, socially, in every way. So these most disenfranchised people, these most disadvantaged people, are the benefactors of her charity. Where was I? Okay. They brought him into the upper room, and all the widows stood beside him weeping and showing all the tunics and garments that Dorcas used to make while she was with them. They miss her dearly. I mean, they are deeply grieved that this woman, with such a quality of character, with such a loving person, that she, of all people, would have died and no longer be with them. And then I think that in turn explains the impact of her being raised from the dead. It became known in verse 42, it became known all over Joppa, and many believed in the Lord. And it came about that he stayed many days in Joppa with a certain tanner, Simon. This was an emotionally significant event for a lot of people that started people thinking. I mean, any raising somebody from the dead would start people thinking, but this wasn't just anybody from the dead that was raised. This was Dorcas, a famous and beloved, endearing person. I don't know if you remember when Roy Hicks died, I guess it was years ago now, but there was a big article in the Register Guard, and people just, in a huge memorial service, when everybody who had been touched by him throughout his life in the city came responding, because of all the people to die, this was somebody who had meant so much to them. Now, I never met Roy Hicks personally. I don't know anything about him, but from the response, it's a Dorcas-like response. I mean, a response to somebody who has obviously meant a great deal to a lot of people. That's the kind of thing we're talking about. I was, we had a meeting yesterday. I was sitting next to Kurt McKinney. Some of you know Kurt. His sister's husband just before Christmas died in a plane crash. And he was describing what's going on there. Evidently, as he describes it, his brother-in-law was the kind of person where your parents say, why can't you be more like him, to him all the time. He had a great deal of respect for his brother-in-law. He was a businessman in Madras and well-known, well-liked in the community, and he and his business partner were died in an airplane crash. And again, he said, it's having a tremendous impact on the community, because somebody who has the integrity that he has, who is liked as he is, who's respected as he is, when someone like that dies, it gets the attention not just of the people close to them, but the entire community. I think that's what we're facing here. Dorcas' death and resuscitation had an impact on the entire community, a big time impact. So that's why we're talking about why she is the kind of person that she is. It's not Luke's interest to explore this issue I'm about to talk about, but I can't help but be struck by the questions that this raises to me. What does it take to be well-liked, like Dorcas? I mean, in a way, you know, how many of us, our hearts don't long to be the kind of woman that Dorcas is. Not necessarily to have the character that she does. That's what it would be nice that we long for. But do we not long for the kind of social acceptance, the kind of social, the kind of reputation, the kind of... Do we not want to be dear to people, let me put it that way? And how much instead do so many of us feel invisible and alienated and isolated and alone, and we feel like we don't really matter to anybody? We feel like whatever worth we have is not going to be acknowledged by that community that we're a part of. It's a very, very real, deep, and profound human longing, I think, and human desire. On the one hand, I would like to say, and I think it would be a trite thing to say that, well, if you want to be loved, then love others, like Dorcas did, because that's certainly what she did here. But unfortunately, as most of us have learned throughout our lives, life isn't that simple. Many times our love for others is responded to with some kind of contempt and some kind of disregard. And sometimes our love for others, if not contempt, is just completely ignored, overlooked, taken for granted. Mostly, the problem that we have in social relationships is other people are not thinking about me, they're thinking about themselves. And so we have a whole set of people, self-protective, defensive, thinking about their own interests. They're more worried about what I'm thinking about them than they are thinking about what can I do for you. And all of us tend to be that way. And as a consequence, isolation, I think, is the standard, regular, normal state of affairs among human beings. Ultimately rooted in our sinfulness, ultimately rooted in our profound self-centeredness, that the only thing that I'm really going to, that is of any real interest to me ultimately, is just, am I getting my needs met? Am I getting what I want? What I want is to be dear to you. Am I dear to you? And we have a whole range of strategies that we use to deal with that. But the bottom line seems to be always the same. I want to be dear to you, damn it. Do it. Make me dear to you. How should we respond? It seems to me that there's two things that a disciple of Jesus should do in response to that situation. First of all, I need to resist the temptation to refuse to accept the fact that I am among the invisible. That's going to be a huge temptation. We will try to manipulate people into liking me. We will feel angry with people for not liking me. We're going to go through a whole range of emotions. We're going to go through a whole range of thoughts and arguments within ourselves. But ultimately, the prior question that all of us need to ask is, well, what if I just am invisible and remain invisible for the rest of my life? What am I going to do with that? Is that acceptable to me, or is that not acceptable to me? If God has made me the kind of person And it's really mysterious to me why socially we respond to some personalities and not others. Why is some one person so likable to so many people and another person equally valuable, equally worthy, maybe even more wise, more mature, a more honorable person, just isn't that interesting to us? It's really mysterious to me. I can't even begin to understand it. But what if I am one of those people who has a personality that just makes me not all that interesting, socially speaking? Then the prior question I have to ask is, God's the one responsible for making me that way. What am I going to do with that? Am I going to accept it from Him that part of my role in this life is to be relatively invisible, to not be a social hit, to not be, to not have my need to be dear to other people met? It's not really any different in the long run from a physical impairment, to be blind, to be deaf, to be paralyzed. No one would see blindness as a ultimately good thing, or deafness as a good thing. It limits us. It deprives us of something that's a part of the delights of God's creation that we do not get to benefit from. And yet, God does that. He makes some people blind. He makes some people deaf. He makes some people lame. And every one of them is faced with the same question. What am I going to do with that? Am I going to accept that deprivation as a reality from the hand of God because that's how He's defining my role in this world? And am I going to accept the role that He's given me, or am I going to insist on another role? I won't take this part. Give me another part. We can all appreciate, I hope, how utterly painful the sense of loneliness and isolation and invisibility is. I think we can all relate to that. I don't want to minimize and trivialize the pain that creates, the authentic pain that's there. But how are we going to deal with it is the issue that every disciple of Jesus has to face. What am I going to do about that? And I think ultimately the values of the kingdom of God, the things that Jesus has taught us, clearly teach us that we need to practice the virtue of what I've described before as sophrosune, that attitude of being able to accept the limitations on my life that God has created there, live gratefully within those limitations, thank God that I exist to play any role at all, and not out of my pride insist on a better part, a better role, or what looks to me to be a better part. That's on the one hand how we as disciples of Jesus need to respond. On the other hand, it seems to me that there's a second thing we need to do. We need to resist the temptation to evaluate people, as Paul puts it, according to the flesh. In 1 Corinthians, I think, Paul says, we should evaluate no man according to the flesh. He said, I used to evaluate Jesus according to the flesh, but now no longer. And what is he saying? I think what he means by according to the flesh is by those standards of evaluation that come so natural to my natural-born humanity, my natural-born humanness. And what are those standards? Basically, those standards boil down to, what can I get out of this relationship? What can I get out of this person? Can I, with association with them, be associated with a beautiful person, an intelligent person, an articulate person, a socially accepted person? Can I get in somehow to get part of what I want by association with this person? Do they offer me happiness? Do they offer me fun? Do they offer me money? Do they offer me recreation? Is there anything in this for me? That's to know someone according to the flesh. And when Paul evaluated Jesus according to the flesh, he found Jesus wanting. You know, he's looking back at his pre-conversion experience and saying, this Jesus was an embarrassment to the whole Jewish race. I didn't want to have anything to do with him. He was a despicable false prophet. That had been his evaluation. But when he evaluated him no longer according to the flesh and wasn't thinking in terms of what could he do for me here and now to boost my status in this world, but when he started thinking about who is Jesus and what is the significance of Jesus from the standpoint of God's plans and God's purposes and God's truth, then Jesus rose in value considerably. But that's in the context of Paul saying we should evaluate no man according to the flesh. What he's driving at is that of all the people in the world, we who are disciples of Jesus, we who are a community of people who follow Jesus, should not let the criteria by which we judge the value and worth and the value and worth of other people, significance of other people, in terms that are so familiar with us. There's two criteria. One is, are they a human being? Then they are worthy of my respect. They're worthy of my time. They're worthy of my energy. They're worthy of my money. They're worthy of my regard. They're worthy of anything any human being is worthy of. So the first criterion is, are they a human being? That's the criteria of their worthiness. The criteria of their virtue or their honor, if you will, what's the criteria for that? Are they wise and sanctified? Nothing else matters. The people that we should most honor, the people that we should consider most virtuous among us, are the people who know what life is all about. They've come to terms with reality. They grasp it. They get it. They understand it. And they live their lives in the light of that truth. And those are truly honorable, virtuous people. Never mind that they are social outcasts and social misfits. They may strike you as so eccentric to be borderline insane, but in God's eyes, they are utterly honorable and utterly virtuous, if they are wise and sanctified. It's a radically different set of standards than those that come so naturally to us. And yet, I don't think we can do any other. But the temptation within any Christian community is to just do what comes naturally, to respect other people, not in accordance with the standards that we've been instructed in, but in what can they do for me. You know, I must say, as I watch our community, an outsider coming into our community would not accuse us of being warm and welcoming, I don't think. I might be wrong about that, but we're hard to break into. We're a very self-protective kind of group. This would go a long way towards solving the problem. It wouldn't solve the problem, but it would go a long way towards solving the problem if we keep in mind the right criteria for judging the worth of another human being. I don't know to what extent that particular problem is a problem among us. I really don't know. I know that another problem, just speaking for myself, is just fear of taking social risks. Of that, I am the most chiefest sinner of all. And I acknowledge that. I mean, I'm just basically, I am a social misfit. Start me talking about theology and you can't stop me. Try to get me talking about anything else and you're good luck. And I don't know why that is. I just don't know how to talk about anything but theology. And I regret that, because to the extent that I set any examples, or to the extent that I set any tone by my behavior, it's a terrible precedent. It's a terrible thing to be. And I guess what I would exhort you to do is ignore me and don't do what I do, but do what you ought to do. Take some risks. Reach out to people. Be warm. Be welcoming. Be generous. Invite people into your life rather than worry about whether or not they're going to accept you. What, you know, the worst they can do is reject you. Why don't I listen to myself? The worst they can do is reject you. But to be rejected by other people is nothing. The one we should fear rejection by is the judge, the living God, not other people. And out of that, out of the courage that comes from that, we should be willing to reach out to others and be more generous and warm-hearted and welcoming. That's what Dorcas was. Dorcas was not put off by the lack of social standing of the widows. She reached out to these people because they were people. She reached out to these people because she was kind and she believed that kindness is what you needed to be. she believed that kindness was right. Now, I can't prove this, because there's a different way of reaching out to people, and I have to assume that this is not what's going on in Dorcas's case. There's another kind of kindness, there's another kind of compassion that showers blessings on people, showers gifts on people as a way of manipulating other people. I want friends, I'm going to make you my friend. And I will endear myself to you by being so generous, by being so forthcoming with my time and energy and gifts and delights and so on, that you will be my friend. And some of us can get really good at that. But that's not authentic. That's not what Dorcas is doing. And I think the reason we know that is because Dorcas was not selective. When we are using it as a manipulative technique, we choose those chosen ones that we're going to be generous to, and everyone else is invisible to us. The impression you get with Dorcas is that nobody is invisible to Dorcas. Everybody is a potential candidate for her kindness, and she reaches out to them. In this case, Dorcas had endeared herself to the entire community because of her behavior, because of her kindness. There are no guarantees here. You know, back in the old days, when I believed the Bible was a book of principles, I would have said, here we have a biblical principle. Be good like this to people and everybody will love you. But that's not how to read the Bible. This is what happened here and now in this time and place in Joppa, but I can't promise you that that's going to happen in Eugene in this day and age. You may be a Dorcas who loves people without qualification, non-selectively, with incredibly profound deeds of compassion, and you're completely taken for granted. No promises that that wouldn't happen. But Dorcas would do it anyway, because she's not doing it to get a response. She's doing it because she thinks it reflects the character of her God, the character of her Heavenly Father. That's why she does it. And in her case, she endeared the entire community, she died, and was resuscitated. Let me speculate here, because again, as if I haven't been already, because we don't know anything more about Dorcas, but I was just kind of pondering who this woman was and what was the impact of her life. Dorcas may have never evangelized a person in her life. She may have never led a Bible study in her entire life. She maybe never talked theology or doctrine in her entire life. She may have never counseled somebody else through a problem in her entire life. Dorcas could be, for the purposes of this passage, a very simple woman who just didn't get into ideas very much. It's entirely possible. And yet, her life ended up having the greatest evangelistic impact on Joppa that of this time. Had a bigger impact on the city and bringing people to Jesus than anybody in her time. What? How? By dying. By dying and giving Peter the opportunity to raise her back up again, resuscitate her. Once again, we don't know and cannot control. We are not in control of the impact of our lives. And the impact that our lives has can sometimes be very, very unpredictable. We don't know what God is going to do in our lives. Back to Sofrasune one more time. Do we want to have the impact that we want to have because we want to have that impact because it looks hip and groovy and cool? Or do we want to have the impact on history that God wants us to have? Again, that's not an easy question to answer, because if you're anything like me, isn't the answer obviously A? I want to have the impact that I want to have. I want to be who I want to be. I want you to use me, God, the way I want you to use me. But what we're called upon as disciples of Jesus to recognize one very, very hard, inflexible fact, and that is God is the creator, we are the creatures. God calls the shots. We must make that existential decision about what we're going to do about that. And the right thing, the wise thing to do about that is to say, God, you call the shots. You make of my life what you will make of my life. You do with me what you will do with me. You have my story go the way you want my story to go. I accept that, and I am grateful that I have any existence at all. I'm grateful that you are using me to play a role and to play a part. Thank you. It sounds so easy, but I think we all know how agonizingly difficult it is to get to that level of submission, to that level of accepting myself as a mere creature and not the creator. Let me just address one last question, and then I'll open it up for your questions and discussion. There is an interesting difference between this account of the raising of Dorcas by Peter and the raising of, I guess she doesn't have a name, the young girl that Jesus raised from the dead. When Jesus went to the somebody's daughter, was it Jairus' daughter? Went to Jairus' daughter. It says that she took her parents and Peter and John, a couple of the disciples, with him into the room, and he says, Talitha arise, Talitha cum, little lamb, get up. And she gets up. But clearly there's somebody else in the room with Jesus. This is it's not public in the sense that everybody was there, but there are a handful of people who are eyewitnesses to this raising of Jairus' daughter from the dead. Peter sends everybody out, or at least it appears that he sends everybody out. It could be argued that he just sent all of the mourners out, all of the widows out, and that he left the people who were his hosts who brought him, that he invited them to stay. It's just the text is not clear. It's possible that he's alone in the room with the woman. And I was wondering why would he do that? You know, why not have an eyewitness to this? And I don't know, but it seems to me entirely possible that the major difference is Jesus knew he was going to raise this girl from the dead when he went into the room. I think Peter may not have known that. The two disciples come down from Joppa to Lydda to get Peter. Why did they want to bring Peter back? Did they have in mind from the outset, Peter, somebody died, we want you to bring him back to life? Could be. If so, there's a huge question that is unanswered in my mind, and that is, why did they think that would happen? Why did they think God would do that? I mean, hadn't they seen people die before and not come back? Disciples, godly people, what's going on that they even have such expectations, if they even do have such expectations? And I don't know the answer to that. I think it's entirely possible that they didn't have such expectations, that instead they were coming to get Peter to bring him back to help, to have him help them simply as a community deal with their grief. Come back and help us sort this out, Peter. That may have been their sole purpose in fetching him. That may have been his intended purpose in returning to Joppa. We just don't know where along the line Peter got the idea it's God's intention to raise this woman from the dead. It may not have been until he was there in the upper room, saw the scene, and began, you know, how does God speak to people? I don't know. But maybe in that same spirit that spoke to Philip, the spirit said, empty the room, and he emptied the room, and he bowed in prayer, and then the spirit said to him, tell this woman to rise, and he did, something to that effect. Unfortunately, we just don't know the details. Okay, I think that's enough. Let me open it up for your questions and comments.
Maybe I didn't catch it, but was there another reason that you thought, see in verse 38, that the disciples may have come to seek him out when they came to implore him not to delay? Or did you give an alternate thought on?
Two possibilities. One, would you come back and raise this lady from the dead?
Yeah,
or come back and deal with our grief?
Oh, okay.
Earlier on, you were talking about how we should be content if we find ourselves alone or if we aren't, you know, surrounded by people who really think that, really care about us or something like that. And I fully agree with that. The one thing I just wanted to clear out, and I don't clear up, I don't think that you meant this, is that when I think about myself, I think often the times that I alienate people or am not, you know, befriended by them or something like that is because of my own sinfulness, and also sometimes because of my habits, which cause other people pain or cause them to be very uncomfortable or something like that. And you wouldn't necessarily recommend that we should just be content with those things too, right? I mean, you would say that we should try and change those things and not be content and not, but we do want to change those things which we want to, you know, which are good to change, but be content if we find ourselves in that situation. I mean, is that what you would say? Clear that up.
Yes, I would, but here's the dilemma we face. I watch somebody over here full of faults, full of weaknesses, a sinner just like me, who hurts other people, who takes advantage of other people, who's self-centered, you know, your typical description of a sinner. And other people seem to look past their faults. Their faults don't matter. There's something else that is valuable about that relationship, that they gravitate toward that person. And then here I am, fully willing to acknowledge my faults, but somehow my faults stand in the way. And that's the dilemma we face. I mean, both of us should be willing to change, but what hurts is that I would need to be perfect to be accepted, but I see all kinds of other people around me who are certainly not perfect, but that doesn't seem to matter. They have some social acceptance that I don't have. So yes, we should all change what we can change. And that, to the extent that sanctification just is that, coming to an understanding of my sinfulness, my wrong values, the wrong-headed principles that I live my life by, and repenting of those and changing the whole value system that I operate on, that sanctification, I need to make those changes, I need to make those choices. There's another comment I would make, though, and that is, I think some of the changes that will be made when we leave this life and enter into glory are changes that are really not, I can't realistically make in this lifetime, if you understand what I'm saying. I think sin, the ingression of sin into the depths of my being, it goes so deep, it's so intractable, it's so much a part of me that it just is my personality now. It doesn't make, I'm not excusing it, it doesn't make it right. It's one of the reasons Jesus died on the cross. Jesus died for my personality. So I'm not trying to minimize the evil that is inherent in it. But I think some of the evil that is in me is so entrenched in who I am that I conduct myself in life so automatically that way that I can believe with all of my heart that it's wrong to be that kind of person. But the evil comes out of me before I even get a chance to notice it. And that kind of evil leaking out of every pore of my being is something that you don't easily change. So should we change that? Well, yeah. I mean, eventually God will change that, but in a sense, good luck. You know, and realistically, there are some aspects of who we are that are going to be with us a long time. They're just part of who I am here and now in this earth. I think we will be freed from those faults in the kingdom of heaven, but we're not going to find ourselves free from them here and now, I don't think. So. Exactly. Is that inequitable? Yes. It's very unfair. It's very inequitable. But it's reality. And what are we going to do about it? What I'm going to do about it is where my struggle has to happen, where the fight has to happen for my own soul, for my own faith, for my own hope, for my own authenticity as a disciple.
Very good message.
Thank you.
I'm wondering how much of that alienation and self-centeredness
And selfishness and egocentricity is a part of our Western culture, where we've been raised to be the pioneer, the individualist. I know I've read of cultures where they are more concerned with the tribe and the community, and they even have rituals where when food is killed or provided for, the first thing that others do is give food to somebody else other than themselves, and it's just an inherent part of their culture. And there's no doubt, as a race of people, we tend to wax selfish. But I'm just wondering, philosophically, I know that maybe I'm not expecting an answer, but it's a wonderment of mine is where the line is between our sinfulness and the culture that we've been raised in to be fundamentally selfish.
Yeah, that's a good, very good observation. I think our cultures are created out of our sinfulness, and so typically there's two aspects of culture, it seems to me. Those aspects of culture that are an attempt on our part to kind of save us from the most destructive parts of our sinfulness, and in that extent are good. And then there's other parts of our culture that just are a manifestation of our sinfulness. And you may very well not agree with me. I'm inclined to think that the individualism of Western culture is actually a step in the right direction. It's just not a big enough step in the right direction. Socially, it creates chaos, and it creates exactly the kind of things that you described, the isolation, the alienation, and so on. And so from the standpoint, if the ultimate goal was social cohesion, we are a worse off society than many tribal societies. I think that's true, where you have well-defined roles and you know where you stand, and you don't face the agonizing existential questions that we do as Westerners, because they don't even have the option of, they don't even think in terms of an option to be anything other than the role that their society and culture has given them. But unfortunately, I don't think that's the kingdom of heaven. I don't think those tribal cultures has arrived at the society that one day we will have when all is well and good and perfect. It's an attempt to deal with a problem of our sinfulness, but it's a stopgap measure. It goes only part way. The individualism of Western society, I think, is probably in large part, the influence of Christianity. And it's a step in the right direction in that by giving us individuals freedom to choose, it's acknowledging the reality of our own need to take responsibility for God for my own life, which is a good thing, which is a right thing. Unfortunately, in terms of what it does in society, is the alienation and the angst. But how much better the society will be when we have a bunch of individual, isolated, if you will, in a sense, individuals who have made a deliberate, voluntary, existential decision to live their lives for others. Then I think we will have both social cohesion and individual freedom and responsibility unlike the world has ever known. And I think ideally in the kingdom of God, in that perfect society, we will not have the isolation and alienation, because we will all be perfect in our own individual characters. And we will be truly people for others like Jesus was and like our Father is. And yet, it will not be because it was imposed on me in a cultural role. It's because I voluntarily chose it. It's because I wanted to be that kind of socially responsible person. Now, I may be blowing smoke, but that's where I'm seeing things right now.
I had something to say a minute ago, and now I'm just like struck with the vision of that society that I'm really anxious to be a part of. I just wanted to say, Jack, that I really appreciate what you said this morning, and I think I just wanted to connect a couple of things that that I think are striking to me. In what Chris was raising, there's this sense of there are these things that we might change about ourselves, and then there's also this sense of these things that we can hardly even see about ourselves, much less change.
Right.
And I think that you gave a really good example earlier by talking about your own sense of fear in social settings and your regret for that. I was really touched by that. And I think what we can give each other is that kind of transparency in understanding our shortcomings and understanding our fears and recognizing them, and I think being honest about those with each other is the best that it gets here. And I just wanted to say that I really appreciated you doing that this morning and saying what you did. Thanks.
Thanks.
Kind of a pony back onto that. I know there's a lot of people that are somewhat new here, and it's really very difficult to kind of get ingrained in this group, as you mentioned. And is there any feedback that you can give those who have been here a while to reach out, and for those who are newer to not give up, since you have so much expertise in this area?
Yeah, you're asking me. Stand. Thank you.
I got the answer.
Thank you.
I'm left with a degree of confusion, and I'm sure that this is involved in what you best know as the sovereignty of God, and what we have so much difficulty in the concept. For in the presentation today, I see on the one hand, there's a Christianese expression, let go and let God. It seems to me very passive and very uninvolved, and it might depict sophrosune. I mean, my personality and my circumstances and my eventuality is something that I need to accept. On the other hand, there's that protagonist attitude of, hey, he or she has to be responsible for his actions. If he was responsible, he wouldn't be in the drug scene or in the teenage pregnancy scene, or if he just was responsible. But you see those two dichotomies there that leave, I think, we in the practical sense in a difficult place to understand the true sovereignty of God in this situation. I really have come to enjoy and understand this concept of sophrosune. And I really think that Solomon tried to teach us that too, when he tried to do so much and experienced all the wonders of the world. And he told us about that in the end, really, it's just like the wind. It's so much by chance. So within what I've just said, do you see a sense of confusion, a sense of this and that, a sense of what's the real middle ground, what's the practicality of what you said this morning?
Let me try. I'm not sure. Let me try. I don't have any control over the role that God has actually defined for me. Ultimately, God's will is unthwartable, I would argue. And I'm not going to change God's mind about what role he's given me in the world. So it's not like he's given me the option. I mean, it's not like he's coming to me and saying, Jack, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? I mean, how do you want your story to go? I need a little help, but I can't get the plot right. Do you have any suggestions? He's not giving me that option. So because he's not giving me that option, I really have no choice other than to rebel against the fact that he's not giving me a choice, or to accept the fact that he's not giving me a choice. That's where sophrosune comes into play. That's where that's relevant, and that's where that applies. Is what about those realities that God just is not giving me an option? Now, when you start talking about moral accountability and moral responsibility, that's where God has given me a choice. Now, ultimately, he's the author of my choice. If you know where I'm coming from, you know that I would say that. But it's nonetheless my choice. It's a choice that gets made here and now in this earth by me at crucial times in my life. I make the choice. And I define myself, my character, my being, by the choice that I make. I'm accountable for the choice I make. If it's wise, I am to be praised for the fact that it's wise. If it's foolish, I am to be criticized for the fact that it's foolish. So there. So I don't see a conflict, because I think we're talking about one is relevant in one set of issues and the other is relevant in a different set of issues.
And I appreciate that. It's really your presentation of the sovereignty of God and free will.
Right.
And the better that you can funnel me into a clear understanding of that as time goes on, the better appreciation I will have of the concept.
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, you need to work with it for years, I think. It took me years to really get comfortable with the tension. Yeah. Let me actually try to answer you first. What would I like to do? I don't do this, and to my failing, but what would I like to do is I would like to just freely walk up to somebody that I don't recognize and introduce myself to them and carry on a conversation where I learn about them and get to know them. And this is the irony. You know, it's really true that I'm interested. I really would like to know them. I'm reticent to take the risk to make the contact to find out about them. It's not that I'm uninterested. I'm just inhibited from doing anything about the fact that I'm interested. So if I could ever get myself to make contact with them, I think they would find me actually pretty warm and accepting. But I don't imagine they experience me that way, because I'm just too reticent to take the risk and take the initiative. You know, I'm here, somebody else is coming in new. What, they're supposed to take the initiative? And fortunately, some people are brave enough to do that, and I just think that's great. But I should take that burden upon me to be the initiator. And, you know, that may extend to having them into my home and showing hospitality and any number of things that would demonstrate kindness to them. We're about out of time. I think we better call it a morning. We'll go on and look at Cornelius next week.